And is the guardian ad litem present?
That's me.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for being here. That doesn't always happen, and we appreciate you being here. Are you planning on arguing? Has there been anything worked out for?
Not anything worked out. I'm not exactly sure what we're arguing about, so I'm not sure.
That's fair enough. All right, well, then we'll play that by ear. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, ma'am, and it's Ms. Hernandez,
yes,
correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Subbed into the last minute, ninth hour. May it please the Court, my name is Leah Hernandez, and I represent the appellant Jonathan Bistel in the appeal from the Augusta County Circuit Court. I'm just going to address two issues from the brief, unless, of course, the Court has questions about the venue, but I think the two important issues are the failure to allow the prior testimony about family abuse and the abuse of discretion regarding placing physical custody with the mother. Before I get into that, I think there's a procedural issue the Court probably wants me to address. And that is the notice of appeal on HB appropriately filed? So what I'd refer the Court to is Rule 5A6E states, separate cases. Whenever two or more cases were tried together in the trial court, one notice of appeal and one record may be used to bring all of such cases before this court, even though such cases were not consolidated by formal order. And then the court in Erickson v. Erickson, 19 VA at 389, which is a 1994 case, said, a final decree is one which disposes of the whole subject, gives all the relief that is contemplated, and leaves nothing to be done by the court. In this case, there was still something to be done by the court when HB's order was entered. SB's order had to be entered. And because both the cases were so intertwined, there's nothing different between HB's order and SB's order.
But they were pursued as two separate record numbers. There were two separate cases, nonetheless.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there was nothing left to be done in HB's case after that that order that was entered 40 or 41 days before the appeal notice.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. I would just say that because everything was so intertwined and because the rules themselves allow for one notice of appeal, that the one notice of appeal within the time allowed was appropriate. And so, therefore, I would say that the court does have the jurisdiction over HB's case. Now, regarding the failure to allow the testimony of prior family abuse, there were two objections that I could see on the record, although I didn't necessarily see anything regarding them in Appellee's brief, and that would be relevance on and then res judicata. And I think this court has already addressed res judicata and relevance in Turner v. Turner. And in that case, in that 1986 case, the court said that basically the court can go past the prior order to find out the context of the current case. That would have been really important in this case where there are now allegations of family abuse happening right now, and they would have enlightened the court about the bruises that were on HB and SB.
But in this particular case, there was no proffer made as to what that prior evidence would be, and if we, assuming for the sake of argument that that it was error not to allow that testimony, we have no way of knowing whether that error was harmless under the context of this record.
Well, I think at the very least there was at least an allusion to proffer in the first questioning of Ms. Bistel. And in that questioning, the question was, isn't it true you threw your daughter against the vehicle? So the court at least knows.
But there's no connection between that question that was asked of her and her response and the other witness. You have to proffer what the witness that you want to produce would have said.
Yes, Your Honor. And I agree, and I would say that the reservation of that, I think that this court can determine that it would, that the means of justice would be served because we're talking about children and because we're talking about physical abuse of children, that the means of justice would be served for the court to proceed on this, even though it was not stated. I agree with the court; it should have been stated in the lower court. And so, just going forward, Your Honors, I did want to say one thing before getting into my next argument, which is I would note that in the Pelley brief, I didn't see any reference to any case law regarding that issue. And there are, if you look at the statement of facts, there's no reference to the appendix. So I would ask the court that when hearing argument of appellee and the information provided, that the court make sure that there's an actual reference to the appendix as opposed to just blatant statements that are made here in the courtroom. So going on to the next thing, which is that physical custody was to the mother was not supported by the evidence. The court addressed four different issues when it looked at what to determine and kind of how it went through a process. So first it said, there's been no physical abuse. Now, I believe that the record shows differently. I think that the court can't say, well, these are just common bruises when you have a V-marked red mark on the side of a child without any explanation as to what it is on the side of a child's neck, a huge goosebump. These are things that a parent should be able to explain to the other parent and to the court. And the evidence was that she didn't explain either of those things to the court or to the other parent. Those are not typical bumps and bruises. Some of them do look like they could be typical bumps and bruises, but there are some that are above concerning regarding that. But even if we accept that as the ruling of the court and that that's not an abuse of discretion, all that says is that factor we don't consider. There's no family abuse, so we're not going to consider that factor. So then we have to look at what do the other factors say to us. The next thing that the judge says is he's convinced that the mother is not cooperating with the father. Well, that is a major concern, and I think the court should have abused his discretion by not being more concerned about that. If we look at what mother didn't communicate with the father, she had an accident with the child, a go-kart accident, where the child was having chest pains, took the child to the emergency room, and if we look at 173 of the appendix, page 173, the discharge instructions are return with worsening change in his symptoms. And she doesn't communicate that to the father. So what happens if, God forbid, but what happens if the next day this child is complaining about severe pain and the father takes this child to the hospital without any history of what's happened the day before? That is a real problem. It's not only a problem regarding their ability to communicate, which is one of the factors, but regarding her ability to address the physical needs of the child, which is another factor that the court should have considered. Then the court says that there's a reference, and I'm not sure exactly what it means because it's not clear. I think there's a reference to the father living with somebody outside of marriage. I'm not sure. I don't think it's clear. If that's what the reference is, though, there's nothing that the court says about the person that he's living with being inappropriate. And that is the standard that the court has to address, not just the moral obligation of not living with someone else, or of living with somebody outside of marriage. And then the last thing that the court says is it says, well, I think that the child is traveling too much. And it looked like all the parties agreed. An hour and 40 minutes to and from school, not a good thing. But the court doesn't address why the child is going an hour and 40 minutes to school. It was a 45-minute drive for dad to take him to both children to and from school. Now it's an hour and 40 minutes because mother chose to move farther away from father and put the child in school without consulting the father. So there are all of these issues that are reflected there. And then the judge says, so because of the travel, I'm going to award physical custody with mother. I think it was obvious that the travel issue caused the court to either decide primary physical residence with mother or primary physical residence with father, but that in and of itself did not give any explanation why mother was appropriate and father wasn't. And if we look at the totality of all of the factors and all of the evidence presented, I've already touched on some of the things, but I think that the totality of all of those factors, what we have is we have the developmental need in factor one. Father took care of the bullying in the child's school. He tried to address the issue with mother. Mother didn't communicate with him. He took care of the bullying. We have a previous order where he was the primary physical custodian. Sole physical custodian of these children. He had historically taken care of these children, which is another factor the court considers. There was no evidence that the father had not been following the court's orders. As a matter of fact, even with the supervised visitation, the way that the order had read was sole custody to the father with visitation as agreed to by the parties. So there was no evidence that he had done anything inappropriate in his caretaking. On the other hand, the evidence regarding the mother was that the children were coming back saying curse words. This is a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. These aren't 13-year-olds. They were coming back having physical aggression between the two of them. That they were having nightmares that were inappropriate. Now, I think some of that was objected to as far as the content, but I think everyone agreed that they were coming and they were having nightmares, and that was unrebutted. That they came back in soiled underwear, and again, 4 and 6 years old, and that the mother had a limited housing arrangement. So mother said she had just moved into a new school district. She says under oath, I'm going to move again. My plan is to move again, and I'm going to try to move back into the other school district. So she doesn't have any stable housing. Father's testimony is he's got a house. He has a room for each child. Mother, in mother's home, they're sharing a room with adults. So the boy is sharing a room with the brother of mother, and the girl is sharing a room with mother. So there's a limited ability to provide for the physical needs there, or just a lesser ability to do that.
Counsel,
yes.
Are any of the parties, I did not notice when I was going through all of the information, files, or other the parties paying any type of support for the children?
So the mother had not been paying support, and the evidence was that they were, the children were with the father during that time. So there is an, I think it's at the very end, there is an appendix reference to that, where the mother is asked by Ms. Rogers, who's my predecessor, are you paying child support? And she said no.
Right. So at this juncture, when you're talking about that both that the children have certain needs that aren't being met, neither parent is paying support.
Correct.
Pursuant to an order.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct.
I just wanted
yes.
to be sure I understood that correctly.
So father had primary custody and was not receiving any support. He was completely financially providing for them. And then when mother actually started to receive more time, which there was a debate as to whether it was really 50-50, it was probably an average of 2 days a week, she still was not paying any additional money. And she was sending the children in clothes that were toddler clothes that were too little for them and not appropriately dressing them. And so father was having to dress
Thank
them.
You. I didn't mean to take up your time. I just wanted to get that straight.
No, that's fine.
Thank you.
And just so you're aware, you're in your rebuttal time.
Oh,
I'm
sorry. I will stop.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appley.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is James Glick. I represent the appellee in this case, Ms. Bistel. And looking first at the argument with regard to the jurisdiction this court has over the one child's appeal, I think that if you're talking about a case in which two cases come up as separate cases but are appealed at the same time and come up at the same time, of course they can be consolidated. There's not very little question about that. But that didn't happen here. They are two separate cases. They were docketed separately. They were heard together. The orders were entered at separate times. And had there been an order appealing the first child's case within the 30 days, then it certainly could be consolidated with the second child. However, there wasn't, and that really bars this court from doing much of anything with it, is our opinion, based on the fact that you don't have jurisdiction over that appeal. Moving on to the sufficiency of the argument, or the sufficiency of the evidence argument, we give great deference to the trial court for a reason, because the trial court hears this case. The trial court hears the witnesses, hears the parties, views them, sees what their demeanor is, can gauge their reactions to things, can gauge their understanding of questions and their responses to those questions. This court doesn't have that luxury, and maybe that's a blessing to you all, actually, but you don't do that, and that's why we don't relitigate the facts here in this case. The trial judge clearly heard the facts. He heard hours and hours of testimony. There's a lengthy transcript that I'm sure you've looked at, and specifically enumerated, which often doesn't happen, although in the 25th District, in that court with the regular judge, it often does happen with lengthy, lengthy letter opinions laying out every little bit of evidence. We had a substitute judge who did not do that, but he very clearly stated that he considered all the factors. He said, there are a number of factors I need to consider based on 124.3, and I've considered those factors. And then he did enumerate some specific ones, not all of them, but some, and determined that it was in the best interest of the children to reside primarily with the mother. I'm not going to rehash the factual pieces because that's not your job, that's not my job at this point. That was the trial court's job, and he did his job. I would point out that had the mother not shown up for the hearing, had the mother not testified, had the mother not offered evidence as to her circumstances, her interactions with the father, her interactions with the children, her schedule, the children's schools, those types of things, it may be appropriate for this court to say the trial court could not have made this determination because it didn't have that evidence before it or any of that information before it. But that's certainly not the case here. What we have is a trial court who listened very carefully and made some determinations as to the party's fitness based on the observations in court. With regard to the objections to family abuse evidence, it's interesting, and I struggled, quite frankly, in the argument, because the argument seems to be initially the trial court allowed that evidence in, and that was error. Well, if it was error, how could it possibly prejudice the appellant? And then later the trial court said, no, I'm not going to hear any more of that after having heard some of it, and said, no, I'm not going to hear any more of that, because the trial court made the determination that it was not relevant at that point. Well, if that's error, then the first one wasn't error, and if the first one wasn't error, then it's a dichotomous argument that I struggle with. But clearly the court did, so he did hear that evidence and did allow it in. So if it's prejudice to have not heard it, that prejudice is evaporated by the fact that the court heard it. And the court clearly considered it, because the court made a ruling, again, in discussing a couple of the factors, specifically that it did not believe, it was not convinced that there had been family abuse or was ongoing family abuse. And again, that's the purpose of the trial court, judging all of the witnesses and all of the evidence before it. We then get to the argument that wasn't touched on much today in the oral argument, but in the brief, that having found or having had evidence of family abuse before it, the court was bound in some way to ignore subsection 6, which is the propensity of each parent to foster an appropriate and meaningful relationship with the other parent. Well, that's not the case. It's a permissive piece in 9 that says if the court finds that there's family abuse, which again the court clearly didn't do, then the court may ignore other pieces and other factors such as 6, which the court did not do. Again, struggle with that piece in that it's arguing both sides of the coin. And I don't think that that makes any difference or that there was any prejudice there. I think the court heard more evidence than it probably should have, but obviously we didn't bring that up on appeal, and then still disregarded and wasn't convinced by the evidence that it did hear that there was some issue of family abuse. With regard to the venue determination, I know there wasn't much there, but I'm again confused by that argument in picking the least preferable venue out of the venue statute and suggesting that it should apply when the two more, the first and second most preferable venue determinations clearly did apply. I would note also I struggle with that argument because yesterday this court dismissed a divorce appeal between the parties filed by the appellant in the Augusta County Circuit Court. So I'm not sure how their argument that venue was improper for a custody determination because of a relationship, because the great aunt of the children is the clerk of the court, doesn't apply to a divorce action that they initiated in that same court and didn't object to.
Let me make sure I'm following you. Are you saying that the Court of Appeals issued an order that relates to these parties?
Yes, sir. Yesterday.
Yesterday.
In a different case, though.
In their divorce case, which was heard separately by another substitute judge in the Augusta County Circuit Court.
So it's not part of this record, though?
It is not part of this record.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I received the email with that order yesterday evening at about 5:15 and was hoping it was this case and I wouldn't have read it, but checked the file numbers and determined that, in fact, it was the appeal of the divorce case. So unless the court has any other questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Hearing none, thank you.
And I'd reserve any time left for the guardian ad litem, should she choose to.
Ms. Taylor, have you anything to add?
Your Honor, I'm in agreement with counsel for Sarah Bistol. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I don't really have anything to add.
Fine, thank you. Rebuttal, Ms. Hernandez.
Counsel stated that the court had looked at all the factors, but actually what the court said is, I tried to look at all of them, in some way for and some way against. I tried to look at all of them. Didn't actually say, I've looked at every single one of the factors. I took time off the bench. You don't see a recess after the closing arguments to go off the bench and look at the factors. It says, I tried to look at all of them. And I think that in and of itself is probably an issue, but I'm limited to my brief. So I'll just say, I think that supports my argument as far as the abuse of discretion and determining that mother was the appropriate person. I was going to make the point that Judge Decker made, which is that the divorce case is not part of the record here, and that was an issue where UPS did not deliver something that they were supposed to deliver, and it came back to me the day after I was supposed to get it to the court. So we'll deal with that on another day. this court didn't say that it found... the court in the lower court addressing counsel's argument about my client unreasonably denying. The court actually didn't say that my client had unreasonably denied whenever he started doing the supervised visitation. It didn't make that opinion. All it said is, I don't find that there's abuse, but it didn't actually go any further to make any other comments regarding that in the opinions of the court. sorry.
Well, counsel, the court's not obligated to, I mean, makes a ruling, it can move on.
That's correct, however...
As long as there's something in the record to back it up.
Well, but in custody and visitation cases, the court is actually required to go the extra step of explaining the ruling. Now, the court doesn't have to say, I find for this factor this, I find
right.
for that factor that. The court doesn't have to go through every single factor. But the court does have to address the factors and say why primary physical custody was granted to mother. And that didn't happen in this case. It said, well, I considered this and I considered that, and so I'm going to award primary custody to mother, but didn't say what part of any of that actually supported the finding that physical custody should go to the mother. And the only other thing that I'd like to point out to the court is the argument of counsel was that this court can't review what the other court determined because the other court heard all the evidence and this court hasn't heard all the evidence. Well, this court has overturned custody and visitation cases before based on the evidence and based on the transcript. So it's not unheard of and it's not inappropriate for this court to determine that that court has in fact abused its discretion in doing that. And I would say that the court in fact did abuse its discretion in awarding physical custody to the mother. I'd ask that the court reverse and remand. Thank you, Your Honors.
Very well, thank you. That concludes the docket. We'll come down and greet counsel and then stand in adjournment.